This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today I'm speaking with Peter Metcalf, CEO of Black Diamond. Most of you have heard of Black Diamond, and the more adventurous of you have likely used your equipment for climbing, backcountry skiing, cycling, or other mountain sports. From their humble beginnings in Ventura, California, Black Diamond has now become one of the most respected brands for outdoor enthusiasts. The company now generates over $200 million a year in revenues and trades as a publicly held company. Peter, it's a great pleasure to have you on The Bottom Line.
Doug, pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So Black Diamond's history goes back to the 1950s when Yvon Chouinard sold climbing equipment in Yosemite that he personally forged, made it in either the trunk of his car or the backyard of his parents in Burbank, California. Tell us how Yvon's spirit kind of inspires and helped build Black Diamond into the company it is today.
Yeah, that is correct. We are the phoenix of the company that gave birth to Patagonia, which is Chouinard Equipment. And our roots go back to 1957 in Yosemite Valley, where a young pioneer climber named Yvon Chouinard neither he nor his climbing buddies had the tools to realize their ambitions to scale the unclimbed walls of Yosemite Valley, California. So he started the company not because he was an entrepreneur, not because he was a business person, but because he understood that this sport, where they wanted it to go, this way of life called climbing, needed some tools that weren't available. So he taught himself how to be a forger and blacksmith, when I say forging both carabiners and pitons, and developed unique and innovative carabiners and pitons, which were integral to making the first ascent to the big walls of Yosemite Valley, California. That company changed the global face of climbing, big wall climbing, hard free climbing, and introduced the concept of vertical waterfall ice climbing, which is a sport unto itself. You can't tell the history of those sports, the birth of those activities globally, without telling the history of our company. So fast forward here, 1982 is when I came to take over the general management.
Back then, it was still a tiny company, right? It was about $500,000 in sales.
$1 million. Right. Yeah, $1 million. Patagonia had completed its first $1.5 million year, and Yvon was focused on running that and saw the opportunities to grow that and was looking for someone who was a climber, a mountaineer, really somebody whose life had been forged from the sports, to take over the running of that company and to bring forth some new ideas, because the company had been stagnating a few years.
And you certainly hit the benchmarks and the check marks on climber, but as far as business experience, I'm guessing you didn't have a whole lot of business experience at that point, or did you?
I had no real business experience when I went to work for Yvon. I had been an entrepreneur like many young people were my generation. I had my own lawn business in high school. I had a paper route. I was a resourceful person who figured out how to hustle. But no, I didn't have any business experience. My work career had been for 3 years as an instructor for the Colorado Outward Bound School, teaching 21-day climbing mountaineering courses in the wilderness of the San Juans, working as a commissioned salesperson 2 winters selling men's suits, and working for 2 winters as a oil field roughneck on Wildcat drilling rigs in southwestern Wyoming and the very corner here of Utah in Echo Canyon, throwing chain in doing that. And I just decided that finally, after doing that for a number of years to support my climbing habit, I wanted to do something different, and began connecting with different people in the very, at the time, embryonic outdoor industry, looking for how could I contribute. And what I did know was I was a hard worker. I knew the sports of climbing, mountaineering, and off-piste skiing. I certainly knew the community exceedingly well. I had an idea of where these activities were going, what the opportunities were for innovation. And I had a combination of humility and self-confidence.
And you know, I think that's a great combination for the type of company that Chouinard was trying to build. I think given a choice between, hey, here's a guy that you know can run a business but doesn't know much about climbing, and here's Peter Metcalf that knows a lot about climbing. It's the very fiber of who you are. but doesn't have that in-depth business experience yet. Obviously, that gamble paid off handsomely. In the first 7 years that you were the general manager for Chouinard Equipment, they went from a little over $500,000 a year in sales to almost $6 million, which is a huge inflection point for the company. What led to that success? What allowed you that tenfold increase of sales over, 7 years?
That's a very good question. And I think fundamentally it was, I look back at how Yvon had created Chouinard Equipment and had made it the iconic company it had become in 25 years, even though the revenue footprint wasn't very big. The influence footprint on the sports of climbing, mountaineering, and alpinism were huge. And what I recognized was he did that because he had an intimacy with the sports, and that intimacy gave insight, and that insight allowed for innovation. And so what I saw was, okay, Yvon had not been active really in the sports for a number of years. I had been, and saw where the activities in sports were going. So it was taking the small infrastructure that Chouinard Equipment had as both a brand, some distribution, a reputation, and the ability to manufacture, rather crudely, but product.
Probably best in class at the time, though.
It was
today's standard.
By today's standards, it seems, as I look back at what we had at that time, it's almost, by today's standards, laughable. Arriving there at that time, that was absolutely best of class, but relatively crude. And so to me, the idea was I need to think about the company not as a maker of just carabiners and pitons and some nuts, but as a company that is committed to the sports, committed to the activities, committed to the community, and what is the product that that community of people who I am a part of need. And so it was about bringing in as quickly as we could afford them additional people who could help me, whose life had been forged by the sports, by the activities. And together we began to brainstorm what were the product opportunities. And it didn't have to be hardware. And I'm really proud to say that the first products that I brought forth in 1983, some of those are really still in the line today. Here we are 30-some years later, and the Megamid Pyramid, a tent using a single pole that you could put a bike in for bike camping that was perfect for climbers, put two trekking poles together. The BOD harness, the new generation, which isn't new so much anymore, Hexentrix and stoppers.
It's pretty amazing that some of these products have lasted 20 years. It's an unusual industry in that respect. One of the pieces of equipment that is not with us today that was back there when you first took over, and you'd mentioned it several times, is the pitons. And that got to be very controversial as more people started climbing. It was damaging the walls of the mountain. I believe it was Chouinard Equipment at the time. It might have been Black Diamond. Made the decision, we're gonna come up with a better way to do this. What I believe the term is clean climbing.
Yes.
That was a very risky thing for the company to do at the time. Tell us how that decision to do, in hindsight, which what is clearly the right thing. But at the time, it probably felt like you were risking the very business itself. How did you make the decision to do that?
Yeah. So let me just give the chronology, which is that had happened just before I got there and several years before I'd gotten there. And let me just explain the genesis of that was that climbing began to increase in popularity in the late 60s. I started climbing in 1969. And by the early 70s, it was minuscule, really, when you look at today's numbers. But at that time, the numbers were increasing enough. And on the more popular routes in Yosemite and elsewhere, the hammering in of Chouinard chromoly pitons. And Yvon and Chouinard Equipment changed climbing because it introduced, in the late 1950s, the first hardened steel, systematically sized pitons, which you would place them and then you could remove them. Prior to that time, the pitons, when placed, European irons with soft iron, and you placed them and you left them. They could not come out. They melded themselves to the crack and were just forged into the rock. But the problem with that was that you could not do a 30-pitch climb and get up El Capitan or the North Face, the Cima Grande, or something like that. You had to be able to remove them so you could go pitch after pitch after pitch. What Yvon found by the 1960s, late 60s, was that these pitons that one placed over and over as multiple parties ascended these routes, what was at one time a micro crack taking a razor-thin piton had become a 2-inch bong crack because you were destroying the rock every time you put it in and then you took it out. And Yvon at that point recognized that the sport that he loved, the product that he had introduced, was decimating the environment. There had to be another alternative. And that is where he came up with the idea of, he didn't invent, and we should say that Chouinard Equipment and Black Diamond, much like Apple Computer, really has invented very little, but what we have taken are concepts and refined them and made them appropriate for the user because of our intimacy. So he took the concept of nuts, which really owe themselves back to British climbers walking up the Snowdon Railroad to Cloggy, finding these nuts that had vibrated free off of the screws holding railroad ties down, and they had fed rope through those and realized occasionally if you had a tapered crack, you could put that in the crack, put a carabiner to it, and use that versus a piton. Yvon and Tom Frost and Dennis Hennick, his two partners in the business at the time, looked at this and realized that, gosh, if you approach these the same way he had approached pitons in the 1950s, systematically size them, put an engineer on them, really study what cracks really look like, you could come up with a shape that would be, come up with a whole collection of those that would fit any size crack, and those would be hand-placed and hand-removed, and you didn't have to hammer them in.
Wouldn't damage the rock then.
You wouldn't damage the rock. The
but
irony
you
of
Chouinard... You didn't know, though, if that would be widely accepted here in the United States.
No, he didn't. So. And there was some risk because you were then tanking your piton business. But you know the really interesting irony of this was that Yvon introduced it because it was good for the environment. The climbing world embraced it because it made climbing easier.
And it's nice when it works out that way. So
yeah.
So that transition took place just before you joined the company.
That's correct.
What about since you've joined the company? Have there been decisions that you've had to make as a business leader that said, you know what, this is the right thing to do. It may not be in our financial interest short term, but we're going to do it anyways because that's who we are.
Yeah, I think that probably the best way to answer that question, Doug, is to say that the business, when whether it was Chouinard Equipment or Black Diamond, which was created in the late 80s out of Chouinard Equipment, was started, what I said we were doing was we were creating a business that was being created to make a difference on behalf of a fellow community users. It's what I call the sustainable why that we're in business. And how we were going to do that was by continuing to bring forth innovative products of exemplary durability targeted towards our core customers. Products that would really be at times paradigm changing or at least make you safer, allow you to perform at a higher level, or make you more comfortable. And the second part of the how were we going to do that was to champion the issues of great importance to that community. Advocacy, activism for access, for places, for your right to engage in off-piste skiing and climbing. And we also said that the style in which we accomplish our goals is every bit as important as what we set out to accomplish, which is the mantra of climbing. Everything that's going to be climbed or skied, for all intents and purposes, has been done. The question is, what style have you done it in? That is what is most important. That's what people are interested in. So I think we've been very true to that mantra. And throughout our history, there have been times where there has been expeditious things we could have done. There are product categories that we could have entered, things we could have done, be a Me Too company, but it would not have been accretive to our positioning. And I don't think it would have been accretive to the long-term success that we have enjoyed. And so it is always thinking about the medium and long term more than the short term to make sure that you're building what I like to call a built-to-last sustainable business.
Let me tell you how I was first introduced to Black Diamond. My brother, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. My brother-in-law and my sister live in Cleveland, Ohio. And they wanted to introduce me to what they called rock climbing, mountain climbing. And there it really is rock climbing. There's not a whole lot of mountains in Cleveland, Ohio. And they would go down to Seneca Rocks, I think, in West Virginia.
Yeah.
So we did a little bit of bouldering, a little bit of this, and I enjoyed it. It's a good workout. You're outdoors. You have good conversations with the people you're with. So they said, let's go down to Seneca Rocks. So now it's this big adventure that we're going on. And while we're down there, you know, I'd done enough that I had seen the equipment, but I didn't know much about it. So while we're, you know, it's a long drive down there. We're talking about whatever. And I start asking them about the equipment, and all of his equipment is Black Diamond equipment, and all his clothing at the time was Patagonia. And I'm like, why is this? Are all climbers like this? And he kind of told me the story of Patagonia. He told me the story of Black Diamond. One of the reasons he said that he was so passionate about Black Diamond was, you know, when you're hanging on the wall, when something goes wrong, you know you can trust the equipment. And the story he told me was of an ice axe that you guys had made years earlier and sold tens of thousands of them. And I guess there had been problems with one or two of them. And you guys said, you know what, we're going to recall them all because that's just who we are. Is that story relatively factual? Because I'm hearing it from my brother-in-law. Yeah. And how was a decision like that made?
Yeah, well, that's a great story. That is very factual. And regrettably or realistically, it's not the only one of those that has occurred in our history. It's just the nature of, you hear about automobile recalls. And so recalls are a difficult thing to do because...
But in the auto industry, the government says you have to do a recall. Right. In your industry, you do it because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, no, that is correct. And really what it was predicated upon, I should say that our quality assurance manager at the time had been the former brewmaster of the brewery up on Main Street, Park City, Melly Pullman. And after she left BD, she went on to get her master's and PhD and ended up being tenured faculty, I think, at the University of Texas, Austin or Houston. And actually put that into a textbook, that case study. So I've gotten to go down to BYU at times. They do that case study. They talk about how would you, if you were CEO, handled this. And I listen to that, and then I get to come up from the back and talk about to the class what I did. So the way we looked at that situation, and really any time we have a ethical question like that, is from the perspective of us, we're users. All of us in the company are users. And as you can tell, I'm getting a bit older. My kids are users. I have a lot of employees whose parents are users. Their best friends use the product. The question this comes down to, are you comfortable using the product? Are you comfortable knowing that your father, daughter, son, brother, sister, your best friend is out there with that product? If you couldn't tell them that, hey, just take a look at your ice axe and give it a good inspection and 'cause I'm concerned about it. If we have those feelings, we need to recall it because we can't reach everyone like that. So if we have any concern whatsoever that we would want to tell ourselves or our kids, hey, just check that product out, then we recall it. We have to have 100% confidence in it. It doesn't matter what the cost is. If one person was to get hurt that shouldn't have, we will have to live with that. We would have to live with that.
You know, and I think that's how all of us as consumers want the companies that we deal with to make decisions, right? It pains me when it comes out that, you know, a company did an ROI and said, you know what, it's cheaper to just pay the lawsuits that are going to come from this versus doing the right thing. And unfortunately, we as humans are wired to forget about that stuff pretty quickly. Particularly with cars, I'm actually surprised how quickly America forgets about some of the what I would call poor decisions that executives at auto companies have made. And so I applaud you for doing that.
Thanks, Doug.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Peter Metcalf, CEO of Black Diamond. For the longest time, Black Diamond was not in the apparel business. In fact, back in the Chouinard Equipment days, the apparel business was kind of it spun off almost by accident how you got into the apparel business. And the decision was consciously made that apparel and equipment should be separated.
We made the decision to go into apparel. Really, it was in 2010, and part of the several reasons, some of which I articulated, that we did the deal to go public was in order to have the growth capital to do apparel in the way that I wanted to do it, not as a sideline, but to do it as a major thrust of the business. And I just felt that we didn't have the capital to continue to invest in our gear and equipment businesses on a global basis and maintain our leadership and also have the capital to do apparel in the right way. And so part of the idea of going public was to say, okay, we're going to continue to build this great, vibrant gear and equipment business, but we're going to build a apparel business to match that on par with that business. That would just be the perfect yang and yin, bring symmetry to the brand. Because gear and equipment is, it's kind of male. It's a little bit testosterone. It's engineered in a beautiful way, but apparel is more sensuous. It's more female. It's more artistic. It's softer. There's a beauty to it. And when you bring gear and equipment properly together with the well-designed apparel that has the same sort of philosophy of intimacy with the sports, manifesting that insight that comes from that, there's a symmetry and a beauty to that, both in how the product aligns and also in your workforce as you begin to bring in additional people who have a different approach to designing product than your engineers.
So you're clearly an icon in the outdoor industry, and certainly here in Utah. Your name's synonymous with Black Diamond. It's synonymous with insanely great gear. And importantly, it's also synonymous with environmental stewardship. Many of our listeners are going to be surprised to hear that you recently made the decision to step down as CEO of Black Diamond sometime between now and June of next year, 2015. You're still going to remain active in the leadership of the company, the culture, and the advocacy for Black Diamond. Why did you decide to make this change?
Yeah, very good question. It's something I've had to spend quite a bit of time explaining to my employees around the world, meeting with them, talking them through it. Everybody's a little bit shocked. And so here's the reason, and bear with me a moment, is that I went to work in 1982 for Yvon Chouinard at Chouinard Equipment. And at that time, Yvon shared with me a little bit about his challenges that he had two partners at one point in his business, Tom Frost and Dennis Hennick. The partnerships didn't work quite well enough.
And partnerships are hard.
They're very difficult. And my takeaway, and I saw Tom and I saw Dennis and got to know both of them, great people, but you recognize that people's trajectory as proprietors and business people, they change. And for them to run parallel, three people in a trajectory or two or more, doesn't work that well. And in starting Black Diamond, I recognized I had three people who were incredibly important to me to get that business going out of Chouinard Equipment, who were my peers, and the employees were very helpful. As a matter of fact, there were a lot of people that were helpful. But my point is, I recognized very early on when they wanted to do it as a partnership, I said, it's absolutely flawed. I'm not going to start a business that has any kind of partnerships. I don't care if I have a majority or whatever. And secondly, it is not about any one of us. This company is going to be bigger than any one of us. It's about the community. It's about the sport. And that's why we're starting it, to make a difference for a fellow community of users. And if this company is going to be successful, it's going to be successful in part because it's bigger than any of us. It's going to go beyond any of our trajectories in business. So I, from the very beginning, put together a board of directors. And it was the board, included some of the people who helped me get the business going, who are my fellow employees. But clearly, as time went on, as I said, trajectories don't match the trajectories of business. Each one of those people, at some point, I had to ask to depart because where we were and what we needed was no longer aligned with their skills, their strengths, and where they were and their commitment to the job and how hard they wanted to work.
It's got to be really hard to do.
It is. Yeah, it is. It is hard, so long as... But what makes it easier is the recognition that you're building something great. You're building something that's making a difference to a much larger group of people. So that all worked fine. I kept telling people we're building a built-to-last company. And it really felt great to get to 2010, nearly $100 million in revenue, a global business. Several different generations of people had come into the company. We had a great leadership team. But I recognized we still had a couple of very important issues that would prevent me from ever saying I had been successful relative to what I had set out with that group of people to do, which was to create a built-to-last business bigger than any one individual. And it was the issue that is something that most entrepreneurs face at some point, which is how do you decouple the issues of liquidity for those who started the business, growth capital to continue to grow the business, the role that the CEO, founder, and chairman of the board, which was my titles, and my 90-some percent of my net worth was tied up in the business, how do you decouple those? And how do you decouple them in a way that if, in my case, I had no plan to leave the business. I wanted to continue running and guiding this business, but I wanted to begin to crack the nut and decouple these issues. And many people on my board said, just sell the whole thing, leave, and we'll all be happy and let somebody else figure it out. It's like, no, that's not why I started the business. It is not what we were setting out to do. So in May of 2010, took the company public through a unique and sort of aardvarkian means. But part of the reason I did that was to begin the process of decoupling. And it was to get liquidity for those who wanted it, growth capital for the business, and to begin to set the stage for myself to be able to depart at some point and have the business continue to go on without me.
Okay. So that was all part of the plan. Really, that it sounds like you put the pieces into place really 5 years ago to start getting you to this point.
Yeah. Just over 4 years. Well, I started working on it. Yeah, it was 5 years ago. It took almost a year to get to the point where we announced what we were doing. And it's been just over four years since we did this deal. And I felt that at this point in time, well, I just had my 59th birthday, so I'm starting my 60th year. I am as passionate about climbing as I've ever been. I'm certainly not as bold, but I do have my health. I do have some vibrancy. I've been doing some good climbing. I realized, you know what? This is a gift, and it's not going to last forever. We all know that. And while I still have that energy and that passion, I want to exercise it. I don't want it to sit on a shelf until I wake up one day and go, I'm an old guy. I can say I'm old, but I don't have that drive that I've had. And I also felt that I wanted to be the person who would steward the transition when the company was strong, when my reputation was intact, when I felt the company had momentum, and when I could transition, hire a president, transition the company to that person, and then stay in a full-time role supporting the company and also looking after what I told you a moment ago, which was, I said the business was created to champion the issues of great importance to a fellow community of users, and that was the why, and the how was through product and through champion the issues of great importance. Last 2 years, I can just say, being a public company, multiple companies, POC, Peeps, Black Diamond, Gregory, I got a pretty full-time job, like 80 hours a week, and I have not been able to commit the time both to our culture and to the activism and advocacy that I believe we need to play, and it needs to be done and led by a senior person, and there's no better person than me to do that. I want to be more involved with the communities. So I get to, by next summer, move to the part of the business that has always inspired me, that has always driven me, and was the reason I actually went to work for Yvonne in the first place. And so I get to return to my roots. I get to end up back where I began and know the place for the first time, you know, the quote Thoreau.
That's great.
I am super energized by that as I begin to think about it.
This concludes the first part of my interview with Peter Metcalf, CEO of Black Diamond. Be sure to join us next week to hear the rest of the conversation. The Bottom Line was recorded at KCPW Studios on Library Square. It was produced by Ross Chambliss with technical support by Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.